Welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. I am your host, Katie Kangas, and each week on the show, we will talk about how to take flight and follow your dreams as a solopreneur architect. Vin Minkler manages his solo practice in New Jersey like a puffin. Off the Arctic shores of Iceland, a puffin dives into the Atlantic Ocean waves to catch up to a dozen small fish at a time. Its beak has special serrations that maintain a tight hold on each catch. For Vin, these catches are projects. And Vin is a mighty manager. He tackles dozens of small and medium-sized residential projects at a time. In this episode, I talk with Vin in depth about the systems he has developed to hone his client-focused practice. Vin, you've been a sole practitioner for how many years now?
We're close to 10.
10
January
years?
1st, 2015 was when I officially started.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're getting pretty close. Not all that time was just dedicated to the practice. I started slowly. But 10 years.
I think last time we met, you said the three words that described your firm were client-focused and approachable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that still true?
That's
client-focused and approachable.
I don't have approachable on my website, but I do have client-focused as like big bold letters right in the center, because I want clients to realize that they're not just, you know, a number. I'm here to help, you know, get them to where they want to be.
I love it. I'd really like to dive into what makes your business structure so unique and talk about how it really reflects your life and how it really supports the goals that you have that are just bigger than just having an architecture firm. What type of projects do you take on? What kind of clients do you serve?
So mainly I do residential work. Most of my clients are middle-class clients. When I first started out my office, it was more as a function of, I worked at a what would be known as like a high-end residential architectural firm. And that firm turned away many more clients than it actually would, you know, sign on with. So I felt that that was a little bit of a disservice to, you know, the community at large, to turn away so much more work than you actually take on, mainly because they were small projects. You know, that was mainly what was being turned away. If it wasn't new construction, you know, that would be turned away. So it's smaller additions and alterations, which I feel like is a very entry level kind of spot that most solo practitioners would kind of get. You know, that's the type of work that would come your way. And I just made that kind of the focus, whereas usually it's a stepping stone. I made it a focus. And by doing that, I've found that it's pretty fulfilling. I very rarely work on one project for like a year, where those creative juices can kind of dry up on you. I hop in and out of projects, pretty quickly, the busiest I ever was, I think I had 90 projects in 1 year that I worked on. This year I just broke 50, and we're still, a few months left in the year. So they're all smaller projects, but, unfortunately and fortunately, they are getting larger as well. So it's I'm now finding myself in the next level of where, decision making needs to happen.
Sure. And so do you say yes to everything up until this like breaking point of almost being too busy?
Yes. Yeah. If you were coming to me, I would find a way to kind of get those projects into, my system and kind of get going with them. A lot of times I've really tried to make it so that I didn't turn people away, because that was one of the reasons why I started this, was to not turn clients away. But, reality sets in at some point where it's like, well, I've got so many projects. I'm a solo practitioner. There's only so much time in a day and an evening and, you know, run out of it eventually. So there's now those learning curves are starting to set in as I've been growing more and more because of this mindset.
That's terrific to hear. And I love how you're serving more people, seeing that gap in people who wanted an architect but weren't able to get in their schedule or in their priority list. And so I love how that has been a need that you're fulfilling in what you see in your community around you. So does that mean with all these small projects, it's a smaller geography that you're serving?
You know, again, when I first started, it was all of New Jersey. I didn't really care where the project was coming from. You know, there would be times where I would drive 2 hours to a project. And in New Jersey, that's, you know, probably half the state I'm traveling through to get to that project. So, but I found that I became a lot more focused area-wise to more of a county. And that wasn't intentional because I live in that county. More and more projects were coming to me from local sources. You know, clients that I worked on in the area suddenly refer me to their friends and things like that. So it just seemed to grow naturally that way. And I found that was something I always hear of other architects starting out. They have their mission statement and everything else. And it seems like they spend so much time picking their clients before seeing what work is actually out there. Whereas I think the reverse happened here. A lot of people started coming to me because they had work and knew that I would take on the work, and that it just grew from there because of that.
And you've built your systems around what they needed to be able to get your services where they need to be.
Right, right. I have, you know, that KISS mentality, you know, keep it simple, silly. I really try to live by that as best as I can. I'm using systems that I'm familiar with. Every now and then I'll try dabbling with new technology and things like that, but that services me more than my clients. So the clients are the focus for my company. You know, there's pluses and minuses to that. Maybe I'm starting to age out of newer formats, but possibly not. I'm not sure.
You're as young as you feel. That young mindset will keep you adapting and changing. But there's something to be said for systems that work well. And right. It sounds like you're being critical of those systems as new opportunities arrive, but you also know what has worked in the past, and you're not willing to just overcomplicate it for the sake of adopting new technology until it's more integral into your process.
Yeah, exactly.
When you mentioned KISS, where did that come from?
That was actually in college. That was said a lot by professors and things like that. To keep it simple, stupid was actually what they would say. And I think it's a well-known kind of acronym. And it just, for some reason, it just had really stuck with me throughout college. I never had to pull an all-nighter in college, which I know is kind of a rarity for architectural students. But really because I kept my processes and everything else as simplified, as streamlined as I could. And I found that by doing that, I could get things done rather quickly and avoided the need to, you know, wear myself out by having to, you know, spend hours on end, you know, getting things, you know, certain ways to make it function.
How do you build that resiliency to be able to avoid rabbit holes? Because I know there's sometimes details that I have heard architects in firms argue about air barriers and vapor barriers in walls for 2 hours.
Right.
There's a culture of finessing and chewing and through details and thinking it over. What is this other KISS mentality that you've adopted to be able to find those through lines and build that that gut reaction?
I think it's just something that comes from observing. You know, really focusing on what's actually happening in the field. You know, is the contractor putting that air barrier in the place that you've spent, you know, hours trying to figure out if you want it there? Are they not? And if they're not, why are they not doing that? Is there, you know, an inherent location that they put it because they've put it there all the time? Other architects have advised them to put it in that location. this is what I think architects have the hardest time doing is stepping back from the contractor's role. I do residential work mainly, so it's not a new kind of science that we're looking at here. There's tried and true methods out there that we're following. You know, every now and then, maybe there will be a new product on the market that I'll take a look at and say, oh, how about this zip sheathing, you know, to generate a higher R value? Well, maybe that's something to do. I'll specify it on a project and see how the contractors react to that. Are they reacting well to it? Is it, you know, naturally a product that they're just able to flow with? Because if you break the flow on the job site, the product is useless.
And you're describing how your own process has been fuel for doing better work, because you have these simpler projects, smaller projects, often have shorter timelines.
Right.
And so you're using that to create like test scenarios to be able to learn from these quickly, but also that you're making sure that you're involved in that whole process. And so there's a lot to unpack there. So what is a typical size of a project? Because there's size of like scale of work and then financial investment and time.
Sure. So as far as a typical size project, I would say most of my work are additions. I do a lot of add-a levels. There's a lot of ranch homes in the area that are adding a second story onto them. There's also a lot of single story additions, family rooms, things like that, that people are adding. So it's somewhere in that mix. That's mainly, you know, kind of the bread and butter of what comes my way. Most budgets are somewhere between $150,000 to $350,000, on average. And I'd say on average, with the lower end being probably more often than not, but $350,000 isn't too out of the ordinary for clients that come my way. And as far as timelines go, you know, I tell clients right now, you can expect a 4 to 6 month turnaround on their projects just because of the volume that I have. 4 months used to be the maximum. But again, as I've been busier and busier, those timelines have stretched. But I've also found that they've stretched more because my clients are taking time too to make decisions. You know, the way that I have my conversations with the clients is, it will take me about 4 weeks to get you an initial design from the time that I measure the space to that initial design. After that, it's all flex time. I can't really say how long it's going to take us to get to that final design. But what I can tell you is that once we have a final design, it's going to take me about 8 weeks to do the construction drawings. So that timeline, you know, it puts it back onto the client. Like, they're in a hurry, so they're all going to say, well, okay, we're going to get you, you know, same day. We're going to respond with comments on that. And I say, that's great, but I also, you know, think that you should spend some time and think about things. Because if you make rash decisions, you know, you could be spending $100,000 and be unhappy with it in the end. So I always tell them I'm happy to work to whatever pace they set. And I find that most of the time they're setting a slower pace than I would typically go anyway.
That's great that you put it in their hands, and it takes some of the onus away from you to be holding the schedule. I know there's things in your process that make sure that when the client is ready to go, you're right there responding. People waste so many times. I've done this too, where you open an email, you don't respond to it right away. You open it again the next day and the next day. And then all of a sudden you look really bad for not responding. And you've spent so much time ruminating over what to respond. So what are some of the processes, maybe from client acquisition and the touch points there? So what are you doing from the beginning of meeting a client through the construction process to keep those touch points light, that KISS method really applied?
So really what I try to do the most is communication, obviously, is key. And speed of communication is really the cornerstone of that. It's better to say something than to say nothing, and, you know, say something within an hour than to say nothing for 3 days and come back with what you would have said in an hour anyway, because you've just finally gotten to that breaking point.
Yeah.
So I try to do that as best as I can. You know, if somebody sends me an email, I'll open it up and have my response email there. and I don't close it until I respond. So it's in the way. I'm moving it around. So, you know, that helps to generate a response faster, I've found. You know, I tell clients when I first meet them that, you know, they'll have that proposal within a week. You know, I send that within the week. And a lot of times if I've set time aside and I've got, you know, five proposals stacked up, I'll tell people, look, you know, I'm writing proposals this afternoon. I'll get it to you this afternoon. And it doesn't really matter to me if, like, I just met them an hour ago and suddenly they've got a proposal from me, because that was the time that was allotted to get those done. So I'd rather not make it seem like I'm too anxious. You know, I don't care about that. You know, if I seem anxious, fine. You know, if it seems like I took too long to respond, then that's worse to me than seeming anxious for a project.
That's fair. And so clients reach out to you, and do almost all of them turn into projects?
I've gotten, I'll say, better at it. It used to be where clients would reach out to me, and I'd say 95% of the clients that reached out to me, I was able to take on. Part of that is because of the size of the projects. I felt that my fees were based upon, you know, they're probably considered low for most architects, but the time it would take me to complete a project, say it takes me, you know, 10 hours to complete a small project, I'm not going to charge those people, you know, 10 grand because that's the average going rate. I'd rather charge them what I feel would be worth my time. So it was more about the faster turnarounds. And nowadays, with clients coming to me, I have increased my fees slightly, but it's more timelines that I'm finding are increasing, and that's what's driving people away. But I'm still getting, I would say, 60 to 70% of the bids that I, or the proposals that I send out. And half the time I find a year later, projects that I thought were gone, they weren't interested, they reach out to me like, okay, we're ready to move forward. And it's something that I had already figured, okay, well, that's gone. I've had people reach out to me 4 years later on that same proposal. Mm-hmm. And I do my best to honor those proposals as much as I can. You know, as long as the scope of work hasn't changed in those 4 years, even though my fee has probably changed in those 4 years, I still try to keep that original proposal that I sent kind of true. And I know that's another kind of faux pas. You know, a lot of people raise their fees and client comes back 4 years later and they'll jack up their price. But I do my best to kind of keep it all streamlined.
And are you using canned proposals? Not canned per se, but at least a base that speeds up the process? Or are you doing them from scratch each time?
I do have a kind of proposal template that I use that speaks more about the process. The only thing that I will alter every time is the scope of work. The scope of work is right there on the first sheet, and it's really just a bullet list of items that we had discussed. So I'll update that scope of work every single time, and then within the main body of the proposal, I have it written more of like a conversation. It's really almost verbatim from what I would say to people when I first started out. It's actually, my proposals originally were just emails to clients. And it got to the point where I would be rewriting that email every time. So I was like, okay, how can I streamline this? Let's copy and paste this. Okay, well, where can I save that? Let's save it into a Word file. Okay, if I save it into a Word file, I can just PDF that and email that as the proposal. So now I've got a quick little sentence that I write in the email that, oh, it was great to meet you. Please find attached a proposal. And then I attach the proposal. So I feel like that way, I never want to lose the personal connection that I feel like I develop with the clients. And proposals are a very quick way to lose that personal connection, because if you just send like a boilerplate template, like, here you go, this is it. You know, I find that more of the conversation, you know, aspect of the proposal really helps to soften and allows the client to better understand the timelines and things like that. As weird as it sounds, because you think like a bullet list of timelines, they would get that. But you kind of remember that conversation more than you remember the list of items.
That's really helpful. You built a business around the clients that you wanted to serve. And this is another example of, as you're serving the clients, you're building systems, you're building a business around what makes that service more streamlined for them and more efficient for you. And so that just seems like great practice to be mindful of those systems. Do you adjust the standard schematic design, design development, construction documents format?
I really don't. So most of the projects that I do, I'm still creating custom details, you know, for everything. You'd think with streamlining a project, I would try to just use boilerplate wall sections and things like that as much as I could. But I actually found that it takes you out of the project more than puts you into it. So every single project that I do a custom building section through it to figure out those details that are going to come up in that particular section. What I have done is I've created, you know, blocks and CAD files and things like that that are like highly adjustable. So I'll throw in a wall section that I'm able to stretch and change and all these other things, similar to what like you could do in a Revit file or something like that, if you had spent the months and years sometimes to set up those Revit files. Now, I've spent the time to, you know, kind of create objects within my drawing system that I'm taking a piece of plywood and I'm applying it to my wall section, you know, just as they would build it in the field. I do that more than I have a templated wall section, because I find, you know, there's always a tweak to it somewhere. Oh, we're doing this type of siding or whatever. So rather than building 800 different wall sections, I've built, you know, 10 different components that I can then swap and move around and find that to be faster than trying to, you know, find the exact wall assembly that I'm looking for. I still build it from scratch.
That's awesome. So that helps with your construction detailing. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So I more have blocks for parts of walls rather than walls themselves.
Do you present three options at schematic design?
Typically, I don't. Okay. I get the question a lot from clients. How many times can we change our minds? And I typically tell them, you could change your mind as many times as you want, as long as we're working towards that original goal. I say, you're not really changing your mind. We're refining the plan. I tell them that if we are, you know, say we're doing a family room, and then during the process, they just say, let's do a kitchen instead. Well, that's different. That's not refining the plan anymore. Now we're kind of going in a new direction. So I try to tell clients that typically my fees don't change as long as we're refining the plan. If the scope of work changes, then the fee may be altered. I find that when you don't kind of pigeonhole clients, you get three revisions and that's it. You know, sometimes clients react badly to that. What if it's going to take more than three revisions? And suddenly you can also be at the other end where they love the first design, but now they want you to do two more because you said there were three. So I take all of that out and I say, hey, look, we're just refining it until you're happy with the plan. And I find that by having it more casual, more open-ended, it actually streamlines it, because people feel like, oh, okay, well, it's not a big deal if I change that or if I don't change that. And I find that we usually get there easily within three passes most of the time.
There do seem to be types of clients where if you start the project with three design options, it almost opens up this endless options and it makes the decision-making hard. Right. And so I haven't heard of this process of refining the plan, and I'm appreciating it, especially for certain client types. You start your project out with a clear scope of work, and as the architect, you're almost acting as the guardrails to keep the focus on that end goal.
Right.
Of, okay, you need another bedroom in your house and another bathroom. That's what we started talking about.
and keeping them on task as you go through, and like, how are we going to achieve this? And so it makes sense that you're able to focus your efforts on that and keep everything towards that initial scope goal, with the caveat that, yes, you're open to additional work, but it is a different type of project.
Right, absolutely. And really, for especially residential clients, it comes down to cost. So if you say, oh, absolutely, we can certainly look at that, but just know that there's an additional fee because of that. And you'll be amazed at how quickly people are like, oh, no, okay, let's not even talk about that. So it wasn't really something that they were really interested in anyway. You know, and it helps to kind of get them back on track without really forcing them back on track, if that makes sense. And I have had clients where, you know, we're in revision number 13 and it's going on and on. And I'll tell people that, you know, I do charge at some point if I find that we're spinning our wheels. This is the exact wording I'll say. If I find that we're spinning our wheels, I do charge an additional fee every time we do a new plan change from a certain point on. Mm-hmm. And the reason I do that is because it helps you to understand the decisions that you're making and get you to make those decisions faster than if it's truly open-ended, then it's just like, well, it's never going to get done. But the second I say, you know what, every plan from here on out, it's going to be $500. It's not a huge amount of money, but it's enough money to make people think, well, hang on, do we want to make this change? Do we not? Do we really need to see that other option? Do we not? And it helps those decisions come pretty quickly at that point. And I'll tell you, even though I have that as like a standard, you know, commentary with my clients, I've probably implemented it maybe 3 or 4 times in 10 years. So it's more of just setting expectations ahead of time so that when you reach those points, you can be like, all right, well, just remember, this is now revision number 6. I don't feel like we're refining it anymore. I think we're spinning our wheels here. Next plan is going to be 500. And immediately, you know, those revisions tend to stop.
Do you go into every client meeting with an understanding of what decisions need to be made by the time you leave?
Not usually. And if I do, I don't do it consciously. I basically go into a meeting, you know, here's the floor plans. Here's what I've set up based upon what we had talked about. What do you think? And that's literally where my brain has stopped as far as the plan. It's more on the spot because, again, they're driving it, not me. I'm not coming in with expectations that I'm waiting for them to reach. I'm going in there almost as a blank slate and saying, okay, let's see where this goes.
Really helpful. I've gotten a good sense of how a client goes through this journey with you over 4 to 6 months that they're working from initial to construction. From your perspective, how are you juggling 50, 90 projects a year? And how do you keep these, what systems do you have in place to be able to pass, like to keep all those projects in your brain and to have such strong touch points with each client and such intimacy with each project?
It's really response. You know, my systems are very basic. I use CAD. Sometimes I use SketchUp, Microsoft Word for any, you know, Word documents that I create, proposals, things like that. And besides that, it's email. That's it. That's the extent of my systems. I do have Zoom for Zoom meetings. Typically, I'll have meetings, you know, electronically or, you know, over the internet rather than in person. Just because I find that it's a lot faster because we're not trying to figure out when we're going to have that time to actually meet in person, you know, the travel distance and things like that. It's a lot more streamlined, again, because it's like, okay, you got 15 minutes. Let's hop on a call real quick. Here's the plan. Does that work? It does. Okay, great. And then that's how it just keeps moving. That's really a great result of the pandemic, to be honest with you, is because people got so comfortable so quickly doing Zoom calls and meetings like this that it really helped streamline that process so much more.
It really does.
I can easily mark up plans on the monitor, and you know, it's just as it would be in person, just faster.
And to be able to serve even more people in that way with such a high level of timely service is what a lot of this comes down to. And then your project folders, do you have a project folder for each project?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that's something that I have a project folder template. And what I typically do is I have the last two digits of the year. So like, for example, this year it's 24, then it'll be dash 001 all the way up to, 999. Haven't gotten to that point yet.
Mine is very similar. Yes.
And then after that, exactly. It works really well. After that, in that same folder, I have so the year, the project number, and then the project address, dash, the town, and then in parentheses, the last name of the client. Nice. So that's my standard folder structure. And again, that makes searching for things very quickly. So if I'm looking for a project in a town, I'm like, oh, didn't I do a project in that town 6 years ago? I could just type in the town name and it comes up pretty quickly in my folder structure. So that's why I felt it was important to include the town, especially because of residential work. Not so important, I feel like, maybe in commercial work, but residential work, it's a little more pertinent.
Yes, and helpful for understanding, especially when you're doing so many projects, what the area having jurisdiction requires and the nuances that you experience with different building officials for different types of projects.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have an entire separate folder structure set up for towns in general. So as far as zoning maps, zoning regulations, all that, I have an entire separate folder structure called Township Zoning Info. And in there, there's a folder for each town that I've ever done work in.
And so that's sort of things that you're learning on the side and tracking so that you don't have to be researching it new every single time.
Exactly. And even on the zoning maps in the town, I opened up the zoning map in, Adobe or whatever. I will put an arrow and a text box to each project that I've worked on. So the second I find what zone a particular project is, I put an arrow in a text box and say, here's 123 Main Street. It's located right here. Because it also helps me find, other addresses. Oh, I know a block or two away was that other project I did. I can quickly find it in that Adobe file and helps me get that zoning quickly.
Oh, that's very helpful. Because I've never thought of making marks on these things that I download online. But you're right. It's my own copy. I can do a virtual highlighter, a virtual med mark in ways that help you save time later.
Exactly.
That's
I mean, certain towns, it's almost hard to see the map itself because of the number of, little notes I've put into it.
That's fun. You're taking over. I think it also represents something that you tapped into, that a lot of times certain towns or cities or regions have housing developments or they grow around the same time. And so it just feels like you're riding this wave of need for the housing stock that's available in your region and in your county is needing these certain updates, upgrades, because we live differently than when they were built. And you're there. And so there's a nice rhythm. I don't think it's repetition. I think it's a rhythm between your projects and being able to carry over knowledge of construction types that were probably common when houses are built around the same era and other things. And you're taking that knowledge from project to project. And I think that's really successful in being able to refine your practice.
Yeah, there's a lot of houses in the area that were built at the same time. So, they've had additions and alterations done to them over the years. But most of the time you could step into them and be like, oh, okay, this is the house that was done, 600 times, other way. Here's what other clients that I've done have done to this house. And that really helps my clients be like, oh, okay, well, they actually had the same house. Oh, they did that. Oh, that's interesting. I can even show them the drawings of that other house. Here's what that family room addition looked like on this house. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's exactly what we want. Let's go with that. So it helps to be able to quickly kind of pull all that up. And that's the brilliance of technology. All my projects are on Dropbox. I can access every project I've ever worked on the phone. So if I'm in a client meeting in person with them, I'm meeting them for the first time, I can easily pull up every single project I've ever done And you know, their neighbor's house or whatever, here's what we did. This was the process that we worked through. Oh, okay. I completely get, you know, how you get from point A to point B to point C.
And that's amazing because that is your schematic design process. Mm-hmm. Like that is almost the, what options are available for these different things. You've built your own library, your own plan books.
Yeah, absolutely. The more work you do, the more you can do.
What do you have available to you to be able to keep track of everything? Like even the name associated with an address.
It's just a whiteboard. That's it.
High tech.
That whiteboard, and it's still right next to me.
Nice. And this is actually helpful. I didn't get to see how nice your handwriting was. My whiteboard handwriting is not that small, nor that neat. This is where I'm failing.
Partially that small due to need. I actually need a bigger whiteboard because I've run out of space. But yeah, same thing. On the whiteboard, I just write the address, a little colon, and then I write, you know, is it in CC, client comments? You know, that lets me know I don't have to do anything. I'm waiting to hear back. You know, is it in zoning? Do I need to do a CD set? And if I do have a CD set, I'll write down, you know, in parentheses, when is the 6 to 8 weeks from the time I said it would be done? You know, so that's my deadline. That's my you know, the time frame that I have on there. And I find that helps me, you know, most of the time I'm just in it. But every now and then, if I've like taken a break or, you know, I had, you know, a long weekend and I didn't actually work for once, and I'm coming back and I'm sitting back down and I need a refresher on, oh, wait, where do I need to start? I can just look over at the board and the board has everything there.
I love it. And I love all the systems you've put in place for yourself. I know you don't talk about it as systems or building a business, but you've done so many things that are just kind of extensions of your practice. And they work so well for you. And I don't know how many people understand that you can make a lean architecture firm around yourself in this way. And it takes discipline. It really does.
Yeah.
Discipline and diligence in that particular communication. But you're juggling that communication with an understanding of your design specialty and being able to know how to do these details. And I think it's pairing really well. You have 10 years to celebrate of doing this. And seems like it's still going really well for you. Yeah,
it's still going strong. You know, it's one of those things where I never want to get large enough to where I'd have to hire on people, because I think that's a very daunting task. I think for a lot of solo practitioners. But it gets to a point where, what's more important? Is it more important to service as many clients as you can, or is it more important to stay solo? And I think that's where I'm kind of at right now. I've tried to have like outside consultants, you know, people who, you know, are willing to do like as-built drawings and things like that for me.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some success with that. There's been not so much success with that. So it's one of those things where obviously good help is always hard to find. But also the more systems you have in place, which as you know, these are systems that I've just kind of fallen into place as I've gone. Now to bring somebody else into it, it can seem overwhelming and daunting to that person. Like, wait, I got to do this, I got to do that. Whereas it's just second nature for me because I've gone through it, you know, and I know the reasoning behind those decisions. And I feel like a lot of times with onboarding, a lot of offices forget about those processes that lead to that system in place. And they don't explain it to the employee. So the employee comes in and he's like, well, why are we doing this? This makes no sense. I'm just going to do this instead. And suddenly everything's thrown off track because that onboarding process wasn't aimed towards the employee. It's similar to an architect, you know, getting a client. You have to, you know, go from their perspective. You know, most of my clients, it's their first time ever working with an architect. If you just say, well, this is what we do and that's it, that's you know, nobody's going to want to hire you. You have to be like, well, here's why I do this, because if you don't do this, then this happens. So it takes a few more minutes to explain it, but it comes off so much nicer, so much more like you have their best interest in heart than they're doing you a favor by hiring you. Now, it's a service industry, right? We're there to make sure that their needs are met. So they're not there to make sure that you can just play around with architecture.
That priority comes out in so many ways that you describe your firm. And I also appreciated you saying that your systems are second nature to you. It's a reason to look into solo practitioners and how they're building architectural practice around themselves, because we have the technology to be able to do a lot of work on our own. We're not just sitting drafting all the time. And so talking about it as second nature, I like finding different structures of firms. And I think yours is a very unique one to be like that puffin. A puffin who is diving into that Arctic Ocean and able to come out with 30-some projects at a time. But you're able to juggle it. You've got this resilience. You've got that lean, mean flying machine. It's really great to see. And I really appreciate how you've been able to open up and share a lot of how you're talking with clients and how you're some architectural folk, like, you're breaking some of the norms. And there can be good reasons to do that. It's never a good answer that it's the way we've always done it.
Right.
I don't buy into that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it isn't the way we've always done it. Right. Architecture as we know it today is not like this ancient practice, you know, that we've done. A lot of the norms that are in place are norms from like the 70s, the 60s, maybe, you know, so it's not that long of a tradition that we're breaking when we do things differently.
Very true. Well, any other final things you want to share?
Just the bird analogy. I thought, well, I'm building an office around me, kind of like a bird builds its nest around it, you know, piece by piece.
Yeah. Little pieces of everything you find around you are right. Becoming the structure that makes it feel like home.
Exactly.
I like it. But you're out of your office so much, and puffins actually only come to land to nest when they're brooding. When they're having their babies, and then they are out on the ocean for years at a time in between. And you are on site quite a bit, I think, and being able to do this service. And actually, that's another thing I find interesting about your practice is that you've started to find that specialty within a county, because when you're juggling so many projects, like how many projects do you touch point on physically in a week?
You'd be surprised. So physically in a week, not that many. It's probably at least once a day. So maybe five projects a week. And a lot of that just has to deal with I'm driving by a project on the way to another project. You know, it's very rare. Do I have scheduled site visits or anything like that? You know, it's all local. It's all in the area. I can't tell you how many times I've just brought my kids, you know, we're on our way to T-ball practice or whatever, like, oh, we're passing a house that's being built. Let me just run in real quick and I'll take them with me. And, you know, usually that's kind of how it happens most of the time. It's never planned. So it's organized chaos or however you want to define it is kind of just it happens. I'm not quite sure always how it happens. There's really no plan set in place, but it just happens.
And so you're fitting CA in the gaps, and it's just that you're available for it, and you're taking advantage of every opportunity. That's great.
Exactly. And it's trusting your team. And who's your team? You're the client and the contractor. They're mm-hmm. also team members. It doesn't seem like it. Your team should just be the people in your office, but that's not the way it works. The team is whoever's helping to, you know, reach that same goal that you want to reach.
Vin Minkler is like a puffin, keeping a tight hold on each small project. The systems he uses aren't all complicated or technical. He manages so many projects with a consistent process focused on a specific type of client. Here are three takeaways from Vin that I think might help manage as many projects as you feel like you can take on. First, keeping a whiteboard. Vin's whiteboard helps him know where each project is at a glance. When managing so many projects, this simple system ensures no project falls through the cracks. It's always up and always available,
whenever he answers a call or email. Second, he keeps a record of projects, and this record helps build upon work that he has already completed. If you encounter the same code or zoning questions on different projects, it helps to be able to quickly reference that former research on a new project. As a solopreneur, we may think we are too busy to build a useful database, but Vin uses a simple system of marking the same zoning PDF each time he starts a project. For you, this could be a Google Map, Excel spreadsheet, or just a PDF. It is very valuable to be able to quickly refer to the work you've already done. I've seen many architecture firms where people keep a codebook or reference standards available with their own personal notes. With post-its or markers, they keep track of what they've already learned. Finally, KISS. Keep things simple, silly. Creating standards or operating procedures for your small business shouldn't add to your workload. Standardize things that you can and find that one thing that keeps you connected to the specific details of your projects. Even in repetitive projects, it is important to have a way to dive into that project's architecture. For me, it's the code review process using a workbook that I've created for myself, while Vin uses the building section as a point to stay connected with the unique conditions of each residential addition or remodel. When selecting systems for your business, keep your core values in mind. Vin focuses on systems that help him focus on being approachable and client-focused. His systems have helped him hone his skills into a lean and efficient solo practice. Not everyone is a puffin managing dozens of projects at a time, but for architects and designers who enjoy a structured design process that helps them impact the lives of so many clients, perhaps some of these puffin techniques will align with your solo practice. This episode was brought to you in collaboration with Entree Architect, which is a fantastic community for finding like-minded entrepreneurs who are there to support you in your business journey. Please subscribe, share, and join the Flying Solo Movement community. We are just taking flight. Please join this journey for ongoing inspiration, support, and resources. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Katie Kengis. My hope is to encourage aspiring entrepreneurs and architects to soar to new heights and embrace the freedom of flying solo.